So what I'll start today maybe is with a kind of a ask whatever you want session. So any question, confusion that you may have, I will try to address, and let's see how it goes. I mean, I would like to have more interaction between you and me, and let's see if this helps. I should begin by saying that I know a lot of people, not only you, everyone. No, you should know that everyone that started this subject has encountered many of the confusions that you have encountered. And this is particularly so because I realized that, in fact, even in the textbook, there are some typos that can completely confuse you about what the physics of, in particular, conformal transformations. I know for a while people were confused about when you make a conformal transformation, whether you have to transform the coordinate in the metric, or the metric, or the coordinates, and all of this stuff. And I'm thinking that part of the confusion was that actually one of the formulas in both references that I gave you, so DiFrancesco and Ginsberg, have a typo. I mean, it's kind of a typo that can be very confusing. So let me try to explain that, and then I'll take any questions that you want to ask, and I'll try to answer. So let me try to explain what the confusion was. So the summary is, what is a conformal transformation? So it's a coordinate transformation from X to X prime. Okay. Now there is one statement that has nothing to do with conformal transformations. It's just a statement about general coordinate invariants, how things transform in their general coordinate transformations. Oh, sorry, let me use. That's they use. I don't like the primes. I like tildes. But okay. So you make a general coordinate transformation, and now you know how this goes. Please check me if I do things right, because okay. So far I haven't done anything that you didn't know, just how the metric transforms and the coordinate transformation. Another confusion was, or is, in this textbook, and I think that's part of maybe why there was a lot back and forth in this issue, is that let's first think. Or what is an isometry? So an isometry is a special class of coordinate transformation that has the property that leaves the form of the metric the same. Okay. So what does that mean? Okay. So before I do that, let's look at this equation infinitesimally. Okay. So let's make an infinitesimal coordinate transformation. So I take x tilde to be x plus epsilon. Oh, sorry, I guess I was calling it b. So now let's compute this, okay? So let's compute what g mu tilde is to leading order in epsilon. So to leading order, I just have to do a Taylor series expansion of this, right? So I get just g mu tilde evaluated at x plus, and now I take a derivative. I have the derivative. I have b rho. This is the shift, the usual shift. So b rho. Okay, so that's the left-hand side to leading order. Notice that to leading order, here I should have a tilde, but to leading order in B, it doesn't matter whether I put G or G tilde here, okay? And now on the right-hand side here, I have to compute these metrics of derivatives, and this gives me So to leading order, this is just delta rho mu minus d mu b rho, right? If I say something that you don't understand, let me know, because that's the whole point of going through this again. To leading order, that's all I did. I just take this matrix of partial derivatives. But I look at the inverse transformation. So to leading order, you get just delta delta here. So you get g mu x. And now I start getting derivatives here. So I the minus here. I pick up the first order term in epsilon here and the zeroth order term, not in epsilon, in B here. So this gives me d mu b rho of x g rho nu of x. And now exactly the same thing, but where I exchange mu and nu. Okay, and then order b square. Do we agree with this so far? Okay, so in particular, this means that, let me bring this guy to the other side and this guy to the other side, that the variation of the metric of x, which is just the original metric, sorry, the transform metric at x minus the original metric at x, equals this thing, so minus b rho, d rho, g mu nu of x, minus d mu b rho, g rho nu, minus, okay, I'm not always writing the argument, but the right hand side, well, actually everything is a function of x. Okay, and now something that, this looks horribly non-covariant. This is a partial derivative of the metric, what is this graph? But something that you can check, and you know from your GI course, that this is just the covariant derivative. Is this step credible? I mean, this definitely you've seen in your GI course, but it's something you can check explicitly just by using the fact that the covariant derivative of this vector field is just the usual derivatives, v nu, minus the Christoffel symbols. And all that you have to do is take three lines, is to use the fact that this guy is, the Christoffel symbol is symmetric, and that you know how to write the Christoffel symbol in terms of the metric. Do people know how to write the Christoffel symbol in terms of the metric? I don't have to do it. Okay, so let me not do it. So right now I just did the exercise of computing what is the variation of the metric under an arbitrary change of coordinates. Another question is we have to characterize and define what do we mean by let's do first an isometry, because I mean it's something more intuitive, and then conformal transformation. So the point is that an isometry is a change of coordinates that has the property that leaves the form of the metric exactly the same. So in formulas, what this is that g mu tilde at x has to, so you pick a point x, and the transform metric and the original metric are the same, like that. Okay. What does this imply? So let's look. This implies, using this general formula for an arbitrary coordinate transformation, it implies that since the left-hand side is zero, the right, yes.
On the second long line there, where you said that G and G is trivial can be in the K. like D row, D row, and D mu mu on left hand side.
Okay. So here you
want the upper line.
Here?
You want the line above. On the left
side. Yeah, so this is what the term. So essentially now you can use essentially this equation to show to rewrite G mu tilde in terms of G mu plus something in order V. But to order V, G mu tilde is your G mu. That's why I like to do that. Any more questions?
So in that line, there's a tilde in the first thing we did was to change G tilde of X with G tilde of X, well, to write in terms of G tilde of X, and then write in terms of G, right?
I mean, what I did is just expand this formula.
Yeah.
Did this formula, do you understand this formula?
Yes, but first you expand the X, right?
Sorry?
Then you expand to...
Well, because I'm doing an infinitesimal transformation. X to add something small.
Yes.
So what's the question?
So the question is that it does it.
A what? I mean, actually, so maybe that you want to come down. I mean, actually, I want a bit more informal. So you want to come down and show me a little bit?
Yes.
I hope what? Don't beat me up.
No. I was saying. I'm going to write this, okay, x tilde is x plus v, so we write g tilde as g tilde of x plus delta, and it should be g tilde of
u. Yes, so this is what I got to the question there. So what I'm saying is...
Can you erase it?
I erase it because I'm evaluating this transformation to order b. B is, we thought that was an infinitesimal parameter, and what I'm saying is that to that order, this guy is already order B. Here I have, naively we said you have a G tilde here, right? But to order B, this guy is the same.
If you take the derivative of the whole line and then do like a recursion, realize that the rest will be of order B squared.
Yeah, okay. No. That's perfect. Oh. So the left hand side should be completely straightforward, okay? That?
Oh, no, it's not here. Okay,
okay.
Okay,
good.
Sorry.
More people want to come down? I'm bored to be here alone. Yeah.
So like on the same line, when you say G mu mu minus V mu gyro or something, shouldn't that plus be a minus?
Sorry? Well, I'm bringing this guy to the left, to the right.
Huh?
So what was the question?
Like, the first plus sign over there, is that not supposed to be a minus because you're trying to create the other
No, G-mu? It's plus.
Oh, you know what? Never mind.
Okay, so back to this. So now, what I want to focus on the fact of what an isometry is. An isometry, as I said, is something that leaves the form of the metric completely invariant. So let's look at this equation. What this implies is, since this guy is zero, it means that the guy on the right-hand side has to be zero. So it means that, well, in the more covariant language, I mean, you can write this more crappy expression, but in a nicer expression, what you get is... Okay? Which is the killing vector equation. This is the equation for the killing vector, okay? Now, where is there a problem in... I think it's a typo. I hope it's a typo, not... Okay, let me say it's a typo. So, both in the reference that I gave you, there's something that can be very confusing, because anyway, transforming coordinates is confusing. You have X's, you have tildes, you have active, passive, the mess. But so if you have a typo in the problem is I think it's a typo in the first formula that defines the conformal transformation, so it can derail you quite badly. So what I want to say is that if in this in the text what they have is instead this formula. Well, so they're talking about. But before doing that, let me say what now the conformal transformation would be, a conformal symmetry. It's a small generalization of this, where you say that the form of the metric is the same up to a scale factor. Okay? And now, if you do the exercise carefully, not like in the textbook, what you will find. So just write this omega as, we're doing an infinitesimal transformation, so omega will be 1 minus omega, little omega, or doubly, okay, what is it, doubly? I don't know. Okay, so let me not do it again. It's identically the same computation that I had before, except that now, when I to leading order in epsilon, I get the 1. So I get 1 here, right? When I bring this guy to the other side, it's precisely the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, I have a little omega times the metric, which is precisely this guy. Is this clear?
Yesterday.
Oh, sorry. Well, so I use W also sometimes for a complex coordinate. I hope if that's the case, that's not W. No.
I'll find that.
I think I was insisting whenever I was talking about infinitesimal factor, like that's why I call it omega. It's big omega, little omega.
Yes, sir. W was any holomorphic function of Z or Z bar.
Yeah, so that's definitely not the There are a finite number of letters in the alphabet, so yeah. So now let me focus what the typo in the textbooks are. Instead, what, so this is, are people happy with this definition? I mean, it's an isometry if the metric, the new metric attacks is of the same form as the metric, original metric attacks, but unfortunately, what it's written, the typo that's in these references is that they have this formula instead, okay? Where the tilde metric is evaluated at x tilde, not at x, okay? And this can confuse one to no avail, and I think it has. So the thing to remember is that actually this, if you try to actually compute what the infinitesimal variation of the metric would be from here, you will get nonsense, essentially, because you will get something that's not even generally covariant. You wouldn't be able to write it in this nice generally covariant way, okay? So the correct formula is this. So if in your notes, you should really change this. And this might explain why, for example, when we're doing, I mean, that's some feedback I got from students, that for example, there was this exercise of computing what happens to in flat space. So now let's go back to flat space. What happens under inversion? So some people were saying that this is the same as this. I know. I mean, I mentioned that there was a question about that. And the point is that when you make a conformal transformation, where in flat space we have a fixed metric, so what you have to transform are the coordinates, not the metric. Okay. So what this means really is computing eta mu no. So here is eta mu no x. Okay. X minus y mu. X minus y, no, Okay, sorry. And this thing. So this is this. And this guy is eta mu nu x and so having this in mind is very important also for the first problem I gave you, which was to check that Maxwell's action is conformally invariant. It's very important to understand what you're transforming. And I think both Eleanor and Callum are writing a very careful solution of the tutorial to give it to you so that you can go and check how it's done and so that you can actually understand how to implement on an action what the conformal transformation does to the field. Okay? So I hope this helps somewhat to clarify. Yes?
If you write a metric of x to the lower, would that just be then?
Here it wouldn't matter, right? As long as I put the same guy on the left, right or the left, it doesn't matter.
But you always need to, if you want to express one side in terms of x, you need to have the same x on the other side.
I didn't get that.
But you can't have a tilde on one side and not.
That makes absolute, yeah, so that makes no sense, in fact. It's not even coordinate invariant.
Yeah. It's not quite obvious to me. How do you get to the equation in the box down below,
okay,
the equation above, like the
okay
transformation?
Let's expand. Okay. So I've done almost all the work. So are we happy with this equation infinitesimally?
That's true.
Yes. And now I just know what this is because Einstein told me, and that's how I make it transform. So the left hand side is just this, right? It's this the variation of the map of the difference between g mu field and g mu nu. It's just minus b mu plus d mu equals minus. So we're having it here, right? And now I can just take the trace, namely, well, first of all, the signs cancel, right? So. And now I contract this equation with g mu nu. So this just gives me the inner product. Okay, very pedantically, v mu, not mu, v mu, but twice that, right? Because this guy is exactly the same. The mesh is symmetric, no? So like twice this equals, oh no, exactly, yes. So now I'm taking the trace. What is g mu in the dimension?
D.
Okay, so you get 2 times D times little omega x. So that tells me what omega x is, right? Tells me that omega x is 1 over D, the gradient of V. And now I just plug it back into here. And I get, okay, and let me not write it again. You get this. Some more questions about this or anything else? Yes.
First lectures, you claim that T mu nu contracted with the vector that generates the Korner transformation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why? Where do you see that?
Okay. I mean, when you say I claim, it's not that I made it up. So do you want to know why T mu nu times a vector field gives you a construct car. Okay, so let's see. So there are several ways of answering this. One of them. So one of them was by construction. So I gave you the stress tensor that you know how to construct, right, from varying the action with respect to the metric. And then I gave you B nu, which are the conformal Killing vectors. And now I construct an object. So I'm very smart. So I just say, oh, let me try this. And then you can show that if this guy is symmetric and traceless, that d mu j mu of x is 0, which is the definition of a concept current. Now, you want to define it, you want to derive it from a more fundamental point of view. The way you should think about this is?
Let's get the form.
Yeah, so I'm cheating a little bit. So I'm using that already. So. But the way you derive this is okay. Yeah. So this is what you get from the variation. Okay. And what I used here that is delta G mu nu, right? I'm in flat space now. I'm not making things. And I use the fact that G mu nu is symmetric by construction. So I can write this as so remember that when you looked at Noether's theorem, the statement was that the variation of the action. Well, no, but if you make the parameter to be not exactly the parameter that would give you symmetry, what this tells you is that what you get is the variation of the action is the derivative of the current times the parameter. And that's why this is the current. So the general statement, more generally, the statement is that if you have a global symmetry, you have a global symmetry. And so that means that the parameters are constants, okay? So you transform your field with some infinitesimal parameters W, which are constants. But now in order to figure out what another current is, you make it slightly not constant. If this was a constant, as you said, delta S would be 0, right? Because that's the definition of what the symmetry is. But now I'm making it slightly non-constant. And this is precisely this. You can write it as. Something. It's something that is first order in the infinitesimal parameter and has the property that would make things vanish if B was a constant. That's what you get. And now for a stress tensor, I have to tell you which of the transformations I'm making, so I have to append the stress tensor, the different variation, with which particular transformation you're making. So so that's why this is the right transformation. Also, you can, I mean, you can derive it also from the Nether method. From the Nether method, compute this for rotations, translations, all the different guys, and you always get this form. Of course, it's the canonical one, not the Nether one, but it always takes this form. Just by explicit construction. I mean, if you don't like this more formal argument, which in fact, that's the better one, but if you just want to do it explicitly, just use the formula for the Nether current for the various generators of translations, and you'll always write it like this, explicitly. It's something you can really do. Both using this more kind of general argument that applies to any global symmetry, or if you just care about global symmetry, then you can just do the another method to get the associated current. More questions?
Can you please raise that blue?
Yeah. Can you explain what's primary once again and secondary?
Okay. Do you get it into the dimensions of higher dimensions, or do you want it in general dimensions or in two dimensions?
Why does it matter?
Yeah.
Well, whether you want to use Z or X. The reason I'm maybe a bit hesitant to go into the dimension is that it's perhaps a richer structure, so I want to separate what the issues are. So in higher dimensions, I'll do it in both. So you want to know, so the way we define primary is as operators that transform nicely under conformal transformation. Okay. So let me tell you a few things about this. So, well, let me write the formula and then we'll discuss it a little bit. So, notice. And remember that we discussed carefully already for the Poincaré group that when you have an operator, okay, I have to put labels, so let me put labels. Even in the Poincaré group, you have to specify various quantum numbers of your operator. Like in quantum mechanics, you have to specify what are the different quantum numbers and the different symmetries. And what we saw is that you have to specify both Lorentz quantum numbers, because remember that the conformal group has the Lorentz group sitting in it, and then we have to specify the charge of the dilatation operator. Is D. Okay? And then, okay, and this is what I was trying to call, it's not an ideal name, but I was hoping that this would be useful. I was calling this the spin data. So these are data that is intrinsic to the operator. To which operator? Yes.
What do you mean by, oh, it says charge. It does not say change there.
No charge.
Okay.
Or the eigenvalue. Okay, and then there is a part which is one, which is actually just this. So if you have a field, any field, and you make a small change of coordinates from x to x plus epsilon, that field we'll go back to phi of the original field plus a small shift just because you're doing a small Taylor expansion around that point. And this was the orbital piece. orbital data, which is just the fact that you made a particular coordinate, infinitesimal coordinate transformation. So the finite form of this was something like dx. So it's the Jacobian of the transformation. Now, all this x tilde is a conformal transformation, right? So it's not any transformation, it's a conformal transformation. And the data about the charge is encoded here. It's the eigenvalue of this operator, and that goes here. And we put here d, so that under a scale transformation, this guy goes to lambda to the minus delta. Because, is that clear? I mean, this
quantity that's...
It's like, it's a label.
Oh, it's a label.
It's a label. It's something intrinsic to the operator. Different operators have different deltas. The reason I call this is that every operator, no matter what the delta and spin they have, there's a piece of the transformation that's universal. Kinematical, and then, but there is a piece of the transformation that depends on what the guy you're talking about. I mean, it's like quantum mechanics, you're looking at some spin system, some particle with spin. There's a part of the transformation of that particle that will care about nothing, I mean, just about how it moves in space-time, which is the orbital data. But this part of the data will depend whether that particle has a spin a half or a spin one. You have to use different matrices to transform that index. Okay? And now there is a rotation piece, a Lorentz piece. Okay, so let me write it and I'll try to explain. Times, I guess, okay, since I put delta there, let me put it here. Where? This LAB acts on the Lorentz index. And remember that we showed that, so LAB, so first of all, R, which if I don't remember correctly, something like that. I mean, impressionistically, maybe it's not quite correct, but it's something that you can easily check from the conformal transformation, something like this. Is a matrix that's is an x-dependent orthogonal matrix, so it has the property that R transpose, if you are in arbitrary Lorentzian signature, eta, so eta is a diagonal matrix, times R equals eta. So it's like a Lorentz transformations have this property, right? Now, the only difference is that this guy is an x-dependent Lorentz transformation. And this LAB is a representation of the Lorentz group. And remember that I gave you a few examples of what these matrices are. These are finite dimensional matrices because we're looking at finite dimensional representations, vectors, scalars, spinors, tensors, that have the property that the commutation relations of these matrices are those of the Lorentz group, which remember that the Lorentz group well, I don't have to write it again. You have a set of matrices, remember you had the commutator of two M's gives you a whole bunch of M's on the right-hand side, and these are particular representations of that. So this was the finite transformation. This was very intuitive. I mean, if you were in the Lorentz group and the theory didn't have conformal symmetry, you would get what you usually get under the Lorentz transformation. Or actually, it's just a generalization of what you know from quantum mechanics when you have SO3 symmetry or spin. Things transform like this without that. Okay? Exactly like this. So as you can see, I mean, the way I try to phrase it is in a way that is as close as possible to the things that you know how to transform in spin, just that I'm changing a little bit the fact that instead of SO3, which is the usual thing used in spin or SU2. I have SOD Lorentz transformation, or SOD comma 1, depending on your signature, which is, but with the caveat that's X dependent. But reading it this way, it just tells you that I could have pulled the omega out, right, from this, but it would be unenlightening, because what I wanted to show you by putting it back in here is to show that this guy is a Lorentz transformation, is a metric like this. And then this factor is not so unusual anyway, because at the epsilon tensor or the square root of the metric under the coordinate transformation would pick up such a factor. What else should I say about this? And then, I mean, I can write the infinitesimal form to if you want, but.
The 2D case?
The 2D case, okay. So the 2D case is actually simpler than that, because I don't have to worry about these crappy matrices LAB, because as I tried to explain, I don't know how clear that was, but what I can say is that in two dimensions, all reproducible representations of the two-dimensional Lorentz group are one-dimensional. While here, they're not one-dimensional, right? So, okay, so maybe to hammer this point in. So we have that in four dimensions, the four-dimensional Lorentz group has different irreducible representations, right? You can have a scalar where you represent the matrices. So something I should have said here, you can think of this, okay, should I say that? No, maybe not. You can have the scalar, which has dimension one, right? Just a number. You can have a vector. So phi, a vector is something that has one space-time index, so it's a four-dimensional or d-dimensional representation. So the dimension is one. Then I can have a spinor. Okay, you don't want to know what spinor. I mean, the dimension, okay, let me show. And this index alpha, which is A, goes from 2 to the dimension over 2. Okay. So in four dimensions, the spinor has four components. Okay. But the point is that in two dimensions, and I try to motivate it by just looking at x mu. In two dimensions, if you write x1 and x2 using complex coordinates, then under a rotation, an object that has an index z never acquires an index z bar. Well, that's more or less clear what I have explained last time, and I can go through it again. But maybe just write the formula, and then we can discuss it. So the difference now is that we can think of Z and Zimbard quite separately. So when I tell you what the tensor is, I roughly speaking have to tell you, the conformal fields in two dimensions transform like a tensor with a given number of lower indices, with a certain number of Z indices and Z bar indices. So this is a bit to motivate. You shouldn't literally put the indices here because... But now you'll see why. So here, tilde bar tilde, okay? I have a transformation like this. So dz, dw to the h times dz bar, dw bar, its bar, times phi of z, z bar. And remember that this statement I made here is true for any dimension. The fact I have to specify the Lorentz and the charge under the dilatation operator. And what we saw in class was that these funny numbers I have here, h and h bar, which remember that in two dimensions, we had a particular set of generators that we called L0, L1, and L minus 1. These were the ones that were non-singular everywhere on the Riemann sphere. They had no singularity at infinity. And analogously for the BARP operators. One of the exercises, I don't know if this made it into the tutorial, but they, one thing to show was that you can find a linear combination of these operators that gives you the usual language of the conformal algebra that we used in the first week and a half, which was that you had translations, P mu, Lorentz transformation, M mu nu, dilatation, and a special conformal transformation. So I don't know if people did that, but that's a very good exercise to do. Where now, of course, here, mu and nu are just one and two, right? Because we're in two dimensions. And Lorentz spin has to do with this. These are rotations in the complex plane, so rotations in the blackboard. And this guy is the dilatation. And the thing I did mention in the class is that, first of all, H is the charge or eigenvalue of phi under L0. And H bar is the charge of phi under L0 bar, okay? So I have two operators. They commute. So I can simultaneously diagonalize them. They have eigenvalues L0 and L0 bar. Sorry, eigenvalues H and H bar. Notice that H bar is need not be the complex conjugate of H. These are just two different quantum numbers, but so don't confuse that. And then what we found is that the quantum numbers that we care about, which are the Lorentz quantum numbers and the dilatation quantum numbers, can be written in terms of this set of quantum numbers as very easily as delta equals L0. Sorry. The eigenvalue is H plus H bar and spin. So now in two dimensions, the spin is just tells you if I take an object and I transform it, it will transform always like that, with a phase. And this, and S is what we call the spin, is H minus H bar.
This is absolutely only true in 2D.
In higher dimensions, it'd be something different.
Well, in higher dimensions, you would have to worry about the fact that the Lorentz group, all the representations are not one-dimensional.
Yeah.
So when you do a Lorentz transformation, you rotate the various components in that representation. So that's why we have to deal with these matrices. Well, for two dimensions, this is just a number. Yes?
That definition for delta and S comes from the running D in terms of L.
Yes.
And M.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, so let's do it. I mean, so what is D in the usual language of real coordinates? Can someone tell me?
Maximum.
So how does it look like in terms of the complex coordinates? Think about it. You don't have to look at your head. Think about what is the dilatation? So dilatation, remember that was a transformation that we scale all coordinates in the same way, right? A constant rescale of all coordinates. This is what this is doing, right? It just, if you have, is that clear that this is what this is? I mean, maybe that's a part of the theory. Is it clear that this is what this object is doing? No? Oh, it's not clear. Okay. Okay, so let's make it clear. So, what do I want to say? I want to say that if I map X nu and I make a dilatation transformation. So this is a vector field, right? So let me remember that. I think you know that maybe the language is derivative that confuses you, but we said that under infinitesimal transformation, what we do is this. Yes? Okay, so that, what is the B mu associated to this operator? Remember that a vector field, B, has components, which is B mu times D mu. A vector field is an infinitesimal transformation around any point in spacetime, so that's why this derivative operator appears. It's like a derivative operator. You have a curve, and you take the derivative. You get the tangent to the curve. A vector field is a tangent to your manifold. So at any point in your manifold, you define a vector, which is tangent. So but from this, we find that B mu is just X mu, right? For this the dilatation operator. So this is nothing but X mu. And here I have some parameter, say epsilon, which tells you how big my dilatation is being. And what you find is that this is X mu times 1 plus epsilon. So what have I done? I've gone from X to just a rescaling of X. So that's why this is a dilatation. Was this clear? So in complex coordinates, well, you can do all the I's and yes. Or just think about it. I mean, a scale transformation, you have coordinates z and z bar. So a scale transformation has to uniformly scale both z and z bar in the same way, because I'm treating all coordinates, I'm scaling all coordinates in the same way. So that means that d is z dz plus z bar dz bar. So that if I make this transformation on my coordinates, I will rescale both z and z bar with the same, by the same amount. And now remember that we defined Ln's. We found a basis of, remember that the killing vector equation in two dimensions was equivalent to saying that you look at V's of z that are holomorphic. So things that are annihilated by z bar. So we found a basis. You can parameterize those single-valued holomorphic vector fields in terms of this by specifying some integer power of z. And so I think the way I defined it was this is n plus 1. So this guy is nothing but L0 plus L0 bar. So now going back to the story here, delta by definition was the eigenvalue under the action of the dilatation operator. So the left-hand side gives me delta. If I act on an operator that has a given quantum number, you get delta. And in this other picture, I have diagonalized instead L0 and L0 bar with eigenvalues H and H bar. So from here I get this. So that's one relation. The other relation is the Lorentz transformation. I shouldn't change that. Okay, so now let's look at rotations. So as I said, in two dimensions, there is only one rotation, right? You have a two-plane. This is something that you know from your quantum mechanics course. So can you tell me what the analog of this expression would be for a Lorentz, a rotation in two dimensions? Yes? Are people happy with this? Okay. And now all that I ask you to do, but think physically. I mean, a rotation in two dimensions does this, right? So if I introduce complex coordinates z and z bar, actually that's something that I showed in the class, but first of all, remember how does a finite rotation act on a set of coordinates x, y? So if I make a rotation by an angle theta, you transform like that. You multiply your original coordinates by this 2x2 matrix. Is this something you've seen before? Okay. And so now, just using the deep fact that z equals this and that e to the I theta is cosine theta plus I sine theta. Is this something you've seen before also? Okay. This means that this implies another way of understanding this, which is much nicer. Because here, you are mixing x and y, right, under this transformation. So the x-axis and the rotation knows about the y-axis. But the whole point of this coordinate is z just goes into the I theta z, and z bar into the minus I theta bar. So one way of thinking about this is that z, the coordinate, the holomorphic coordinate z, has charge 1 under this transformation, where the charge is rid of here in the sign of the exponent, while z bar has charge minus 1. Okay. So this means that another way of thinking about this is that this is, well, you can just explicitly check. But, well, this little argument was trying to convince you that the Lorentz transformation transforms z in one direction and z bar in the opposite direction. So that's why you get the minus sign there. Okay? But now going back to our definition of LNs, somewhere over here, we see that this is nothing but L0 minus L0 bar. So that means that the spin, which is the eigenvalue with respect to this generator, is the eigenvalue of L0 minus L0 bar, which is H minus H bar. More questions? Okay, maybe today we will just finish with questions. Yes, so more questions. Yes? S of n is, so remember that it's a vector field that generates the component information. So remember that the conformal transformations are labeled by some vector field B of Z, which is holomorphic. So it's annihilated by this. And I can find a basis of single value vector fields just by doing a Lorentz series. And these elements are a basis for this vector field. So those two weeks, the integer here just shades a particular basis element. And ln is what that means.
So I think before we were just talking about L0 and L1 and L1 some, why did we suddenly start caring with L0? Like with n not equal to 0?
Well, first of all, they're symmetry. The theory, so we have to care about them. And at some point soon, maybe tomorrow, well, I don't think today, we will see that actually. Okay, so it's related to these elements are important in defining what the descendant operators are. So far I was talking about primers, right? So maybe this is a question that I didn't address. So there was a question of what is a descendant? Okay, I don't know if I should get into this. Maybe I should postpone that. But remember, the idea was that. Well, so that's a derivative in higher dimensions. But in two dimensions, apart from, so, and what's the derivative operator? The derivative operator in two dimensions is L minus 1 is dz. Sorry. At this level, let me still use little l. Right? So L minus 1 is just the derivative operator. And in higher dimensions, that's all that we have. Because in a way, this L minus 1, that's something that it would be nice if you check. These L minus 1s are a linear combination of the L minus 1s is what gives you the momentum generator. And notice that something that an important property that this guy had is that it raised. So if you take a derivative, so if you add with the primary, phi of delta, and now I act with a whole bunch of derivatives, well, this defines what you mean by a descendant. And the reason it's called a descendant is that something that you derive from the primary, but also all the quantum numbers that we care about are determined by the conformal symmetry. Because from here, we just know that the delta associated to this operator, or delta tilde, mu 1, so I'm writing all the indices in glory detail, so mu 1, mu L, which is defined to be this, will have a dimension which is delta plus L, because I have L derivatives, and the spin will be the spin, it will transform under the Lorentz group under spin, we have a spin L under the Lorentz group because you're taking L derivatives. Okay. Okay. And now the point is that in two dimensions, and there is a way of thinking about this in which how do I want to say this without I want to say things that I do not rely on things I haven't said. So let me say the word. So the point is that one way of thinking about this is that what you're doing here is acting on the primary with a whole bunch of momentum operators. Yes? In quantum mechanics, we represent P as a derivative operator. And this gives you this chain of descendants. So you have this delta, then you have this tower, kind of a harmonic oscillator, equally spaced tower of descendants. In two dimensions, and we will see this much more carefully, but since you asked, why do we care about them? I mean, well, one reason we care about them is that they appear in the construction of the tower of the descendant, because now in higher dimensions, you can get a descendant essentially by acting. So these L's, okay, these L's, I can act with L of them on some primary. Okay. Now in two dimensions, we have more than just L minus 1. We have L minus 2, L minus 3, L minus 4. So all the descendants you can get here are the ones that you can obtain by multiplying any arbitrary number of L of minus whatever you want. And these guys still have a nice quantum number. You can, we haven't seen, well, actually we kind of have seen it, but remember that the statement was that L naught, you had this algebra, the Witt algebra, Lm was N minus M Ln plus M, right? So let's look, now we are caring about, want to know what happens, what is the L naught eigenvalue of this operator. Just like here we care about what is the dilatation eigenvalue of the descendant. Here what we want to know is what happens if I do this. You get that, right? So that means that L minus N increases the value of L naught by n. Okay? So that means that this beast will have an h tilde, to use the same notation, which will be h plus the sum L from 1 to capital L of NL. So now you have an incredibly rich tower of descendants. You can not only act with L minus 1, but I can act with L minus 2, L minus 3, L minus infinity. Absolutely, yes. And that has to do with the fact that in two dimensions, the conformal algebra is infinite dimensional, while in Hive, it's just finite, just has a few generators. And these guys play a huge role in solving this.
Quasi-primary operators yesterday.
Yes.
And what exactly are they?
So these are animals that transform like this. Oh, sorry. That transform like this, but not under arbitrary conformal transformation, but under the globally defined ones. So remember, there was a subset of the transformations that are globally defined, exactly these ones. And there are objects out there that have this property that are transformed in this way under the six generators, but not under more general ones. Actually, there's a very important operator which exactly has this property. That's why we invent an image. We didn't care. I mean, if a loser operator had that property, we wouldn't care. But the point is that in two dimensions, the stress energy tensor, which is kind of the father and the mother of everything, has this property. It's not primary, it's quasi primary.
But these operators can also be written as descendants of primary operators?
Yes, in particular, something that is very weird the first time you hear about it, you can tell that TZ, the stress tensor, which is a quasi primary, can be written as a descendant of something else, of the identity operator. But, so this is TZ is a descendant of the identity operator, which you always have. No. And beyond that, I mean, that just to tie up a little bit with what we did yesterday, you can construct the conformal transformation of any operator, descendant, primary, quasi-primary, you don't care about, from the conformal word that I did yesterday, by knowing how the stress tensor acts on that operator. That defines the transformation. So remember that I had this formula. I'm going to go back. And maybe with that, it should let me go.
Everything is plentiful, right? We know
that
quantize anything.
So far, this has been a very classical statement, but this will stop soon, yes. No, but in a way, since so far we still have been doing more of the kinematics, when I write that bracket, I mean the quantum expectation value. Even though, some of the derivatives were not classical, but because everything I say is a correct statement quantum mechanically. And we will make computations to see what's the difference between the way you think that will have a classical origin and quantum origin. But these word identities, all of this stuff, is true quantum mechanical.
What was it talking
about?
About
what?
Something about word identities.
Oh, word identities.
How to get the
constructing.
Oh, yeah.
So
one of the formulas that we derived yesterday, I realized that the derivation was maybe a bit long, but it's important. I mean, I could just have written the final answer, but I would feel like I'm cheating you. So instead of that, I just bore you with the derivation. But the conclusion, which is important, is to say that if I make a conformal transformation, infinitesimal conformal transformation, that the expectation value of this object, where you multiply a string of operator, okay, so I should put, they're different in general. Okay, but let's just choose one. This is true for any string, in particular it's true for one, just to make the point. So the contour integral of the product, operator product, of the stress tensor with your favorite operator times the choice of your favorite conformal transformation was the variation under infinitesimal conformal transformation parameterized by my choice of conformal transformation, which is labeled by B, of that operator. So we can relate, we can compute the conformal transformation of any operator in the universe by from the operator product expansion of PZ with that operator. And we will do exercises to see how this works. And in particular, if you do it for the, I wonder if I should do this now. We will see that thinking of things in this term, we can learn a lot about the behavior of the product of T with various fields, essentially, because it allows us to relate the two sides of the equation, essentially. Okay? Sorry?
That's the correct.
Yes, this is the correct. This is the analog of the original question where I had T mu nu times T nu in two dimensions. This is that you take the stress tensor and you multiply it with the vector field that gives you the definition. More questions? So everything is clear now? Great. So I can put the accelerator more of it, right? Not really, is everything clear? Any major traumas? Okay, there's some kind of help with that next time.
I think it was in the third lecture you wrote down all the different, the general conformal transformation, the translation and Lorentz transformation, and dilatation, all that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I don't think you actually derived each of those terms. We derived the dilatation, I think, not the general.
So what do you want to know? Why does the vector field look the way it does?
Why does it transform that way? Why does the general transformation look the way it does?
Can you come down and tell me more? Are you talking about the vector field that generates the conformal transformation? Why is that the funny quadratic x dependent?
No.
Okay.
What I mean is the general conformal transformation is that form of A plus M mu mu plus D plus K.
You want to know? Okay, I think, okay, let me see if I understand the question. So you're happy with the derivation of BUBU omega for the conformal transformation? You're okay. Happy is maybe somewhere. Not discussed today. So we have a vector field like this, right?
Okay. But no, I don't know how you got that. The expression for that in general. How you got that? Yes, that's it.
I mean, that, I don't know what that is.
Apparently, it's the solution of the killing equation.
Ah, yes. I that's something I showed in the class, right? I showed that this guy, it's followed after some gymnastics, that this vector field was a solution of this wonderful equation. Of this equation. We solved that equation, essentially. So I showed that this guy. Lambda, d lambda equals 0. Does this sound vaguely familiar?
Yeah, I remember.
So that implies that d lambda is at most quadratic. Right? And then we just parameterize the most general polynomial
of the repo.
That's all.
Yes.
So we, in tutorial and in class, used inversion a lot. And I understand that it is a conformal transformation, but it isn't one of the, like, it's in our toolbox somehow, but I was unclear exactly where it fit in.
Okay, I have a question. So, first of all, inversion maps you from here to something somewhere very far. So it's not one of these infinitesimal transformations. But the reason that was very useful, well, there are many reasons, but so remember that we had this crazy special conformal transformation? One of the things that are in the infinitesimal set of transformations are the special conformal transformations. And what you, in one of the tutorials, what you showed is that you could obtain this perhaps not most intuitive transformation just by just doing things that you have a feeling of what inversion does. And then you go from here, you're in the North Pole, you go to the South Pole. And the idea is that you could obtain the weird transformations just from things that you know a lot, such as translations and inversions.
Right.
But also, I use it incredibly heavily in the derivation of the special form of the correlation function. I invite you to try to derive those, not using inversion, but using special conformal.
So I understand why it's useful, but I don't really understand why we can use it.
Why we can?
Yeah. Well, why?
It's a conformal transformation.
Yeah, but, okay.
So the name of the game here is that I allow any conformal transformation, the solution of the... So since it's not infinitesimal, it's not, there is no sense which is a solution of the conformal Euclidean vector equation. Okay. But it's a transformation that if you transform your coordinates, the metric picks up some Jacobian, some scale factor. So it is a fine... And the analogy I try to make is like in the Lorentz group, you have Lorentz transformation, but you also have parity. So have you seen parity and time reversal? So let me say something. So just look at in the Lorentz group, you have the Lorentz transformations that do the infinitesimal ones, which are translations plus rotations. Well, this guy, remember, is anti-symmetric. But there are transformations which are not connected to the identity. And all these transformations have the property. Can I say it in that line? No, let me say it in that line. That there are transformations, though, that have the property. So, x mu goes to lambda mu no x mu. So, this is a 4x4 matrix. Where lambda mu no, so lambda is a matrix. Has, looks like this, like minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1. Okay? This is a transformation that has this property, lambda transpose, lambda, eta lambda equals lambda. Okay. This is the basic definition of what the Lorentz. Oh, sorry. Yes, thank you. But it's not an infinitesimal transformation. The infinitesimal transformations are things that have determinant 1. Because the identity transformation not doing anything has determinant 1, right? Would be just a bunch of 1s. So all the ones that are nearby cannot change the sign of the determinant. But this guy is a very physical operation. It's a symmetry. Or it can be a symmetry, in theory. I mean, yeah. As I said, there are theories that are not parity variant. But so one has to distinguish in field theory or in quantum mechanics between transformations that are continuous, like the ones we're usually talking about, this conformal looking vector and all that, and discrete transformations. And the main reason I introduced them is that they're very useful transformation to, for example, understand what's happening. If you remember that one of the things that we're in two dimensions we were worried about is to make sure that at infinity nothing nasty is happening. And essentially what I did is an inversion. I went from the origin to infinity. But if you wanted, I could have never mentioned inversion. the universe that you can put on them. And you could have derived the word identity, I mean the form of the correlation functions just using the special conformal transformation. But inversion is a conformal transformation. It's not a connected identity, but it is one. Yes.
So I'm not, in what sense can we, so I like to think of, in two dimensions, I like to think of conformal transformations. You know, you have a stir projection of the Riemann sphere, and then you turn it, and you know, in opposite directions, and you get all the conformal transformations, right? And you get an inversion if you just turn the sphere upside down.
Yes.
But you could do this, like, just a little bit, which would move the origin just a little bit, and, like, bring infinity a little bit into your plane. Like, do you see what I'm saying?
Well, that's what inversion does. So inversion brings the North Pole.
I guess my question is, why can't we do it an infinitesimal bit? You don't have to turn it all the way upside down. You can just turn it a little bit about some axis that goes through the equator, right?
Yeah. It's not a rotation, it's turning the sphere inside out. So
no, it's not actually turning the sphere inside out, it's turning the sphere upside down.
It's an inversion of the sphere, isn't it?
Well, it maps
the top goes to bottom, but there's
no question
exactly where it is.
And Canada to Argentina.
Right.
No, but I think I'm not sure what the question is.
Is it just a rigid rotation, or is it an actual, like, orientation reversing thing?
Oh, God.
Maybe I'm just remembering wrong, but
I guess, like, does he do the two points on the equator switch?
Yeah.
Or do
exactly. The unit sphere doesn't, right? Pretend you're a unit circle in your projection, right? It doesn't go around at all. It stays where it is. So you're right. It's like flopping, like if you had a globe, right?
Mm-hmm.
You would actually have to, like, take it apart and, like, you can't just roll it around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that what it is? It is actually a turning the sphere inside out thing. Yeah.
Well, you don't have to turn the sphere inside out.
But then you're doing another transformation, which is not the inversion. That is continuous.
Okay, thanks.
Let's
check out. I just have a quick question about inversion. How does x mu with the Deleuze index transform under inversion?
The same way. Because remember, we said that the metric. Should we finish this session of linting tomorrow?
That's pretty useful.
Okay, look, tomorrow we'll continue with regular.